Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to this latest edition of the Serial Coin Review on this 18th of May, 2013. As we discuss the world of sports, 90 minutes. We're going 90 minutes this particular program. A lot to do, busy weekend in the world of sports. We'll get certainly to the Preakness. Talk with our buddy Alex Brown. Can Orb take the second crown, the second jewel, or the triple crown? I think the horse is a big-time horse, and I think he certainly has the opportunity to win the triple crown this year. Also, NBA playoffs, NHL playoffs, a lot of news going on in the NBA this week. We'll talk about that. But we begin with Michael, Phil, and Kobe. Phil Jackson, 11-time world champion coach, championship coach, is coming out with a book, 11 Rings, called 11 Rings, Soul of Success, which is slated to open, to come out in stores on Tuesday. Already, of course, excerpts from the book were leaked out, as you might expect it, and first thing people talk about is the Kobe Bryant versus Michael Jordan, or Michael Jordan versus Kobe Bryant comparisons, and it pretty much was a first-round knockout in Phil's opinion. I mean, Phil, went out of his way to say that there basically is not a comparison. There's no comparison between the two players. I mean, Michael's a more efficient offensive player. He's a better defender. He's stronger. He's a better leader. Kobe's defense is overrated, basically. Phil went out of his way to, I think, somewhat bury Kobe Bryant. I mean, here's the thing. Phil Jackson, listen, I'm a Laker fan, so I love Phil Jackson. I want him to coach the team this year. Make no mistake about it. But, to say that he was respectful. Now, listen, I haven't read the whole book. Obviously, the book is not out. So maybe he said some nice things about Kobe Bryant. I'm sure he did. But in comparison to Michael Jordan, he destroyed Kobe Bryant. I mean, let's be honest. He didn't toss Kobe Bryant one bone. There was not one positive thing that came out of the excerpts that was pro-Kobe in comparison to Michael Jordan. And again, we all know, anybody who's watched basketball knows that Michael Jordan is a better player than Kobe Bryant. I'm a Kobe Bryant fan. I was not a fan of Michael Jordan because everybody else was. So, and I definitely respected his game and respected the fact that, he was the best player I ever saw, without question. But the ideal that Michael Jordan is, and this is where Michael Jordan's always been overrated to me. The fact that the ideal that it's him and everybody else is just not the case. I think Kobe Bryant's in his same class. I think Bill Russell's in his same class. I think Wilt Chamberlain, Magic Johnson are in his same class. So it's not like it's Michael and everybody else. Like, you have the NFL, like, there's Darrell Revis as a quarterback, and then there's everybody else. That's not the case with Michael Jordan in terms of the rest of everybody else in NBA history. But you know, the leadership, the thing about the leadership issue, you want to say that Kobe, Michael's a more natural leader than Kobe Bryant? Yeah, you can say that. But understand this. Kobe Bryant came onto a team that was already established with, in terms of Shaquille O'Neal, Robert Horry, some of the older guys that they had. I mean, he was 17 years old. You're not going to lead. I don't care how talented you are. You're not going to lead anybody at the age of 17. Michael Jordan comes onto a Chicago team that was just god-awful, 21 years old, 3 years of college, mature, played in an international competition with the Olympics. He's a man. He came into the league a man. Okay, Kobe Bryant came into the league a teenager. So your leadership skill, that, you know, the leadership skills are not going to be there right away. So, yes, of course it took Kobe Bryant longer. He was, again, if you start out a boy, okay, you start out a boy and grow into a man versus a man already, then yes, that the player who came into the league as a man is going to develop, become a better leader, develop more leadership skills, have better leadership skills than that player who came into the league as a teenager. Okay. I think that personally, that Kobe Bryant's leadership and his ability to make other players better has been vastly forth, Paul Gasol, Andrew Bynum. I think that Kobe Bryant's leadership has been vastly underrated, and I'll tell you why. Paul Gasol, Lamar Odom, Trevor Ariza, Andrew Bynum, all of those guys who played and won championships, even Shaquille O'Neal played and won championships, had their best seasons playing along with Kobe Bryant, all of them, okay? So, if that's not leadership, if other players play with you and they have the best years of their careers and you are the best player on that team, I don't understand how that can be considered high level leadership or quality leadership. And basically, Phil Jackson just saying that Kobe Bryant, you know, talked a good game. It was not so much he wasn't the leader that Michael was. It basically was questioning his leadership in general. Again, Andrew Bynum, Trevor Ariza, Paul Gasol, Lamar Odom, even Shaquille O'Neal had their best years with Kobe playing alongside Kobe Bryant, period. And I'll put Shaq aside because Shaq was getting already established, was in the prime of his career. Those other guys, Odom, Gasol, Ariza, Bynum all had their best years with Kobe Bryant. And I go one step further, Odom and Ariza, since they left, and Andrew Bynum, have not been the same, period. So I don't know, you know, if other players around you get better, I don't know when, you know, I don't know what that is. To me, that's leadership. A high end leadership at a high level. Players have the best years of their careers around you. The players have the best years of their careers and they're playing alongside with you. Kobe Bryant's response to this, you know, apples and oranges. I wonder what the perception would be had Michael Jordan played with Shaquille O'Neal. That's a great point because, again, Michael comes into Chicago and everything was built around him, okay? And remember, Michael Jordan didn't win a championship for his first 7 years of his career. Okay. He had to go through the Celtics, had to go through the Pistons, those other guys, Pippen, Horace Grant, DJ Armstrong, John Paxson, those role players, those other guys had to grow up and develop around him. And he, you know, over the course of his first few years of his career, was a guy who was he's a one-man band. He's a one-man band. And it wasn't, and it's ironic, but it wasn't until Phil Jackson came, and Phil Jackson said this, not in the book, maybe, you know, maybe he talks about this in the book, but I know Phil Jackson said this in interviews, that he had to convince Michael Jordan to trust his teammates. Sounds familiar, doesn't it? In terms of Kobe Bryant. He had to, I mean, Michael was putting up all these points, and, you know, the average had years where he averaged 37 points a game, had years where he, you know, we saw the 63-point game he had against Boston in the playoffs, which was a loss. So, you know, he had to grow up. From that sense, he had to grow up as well. And again, he came to the league as a man. Again, how would Michael Jordan have done, and I'm talking about in terms of winning rings, but how would he have done as far as leadership had he had to play with Shaq? Who would Michael Jordan have done had Shaq cost him a championship or two because of the lack of conditioning? Shaquille O'Neal cost the Lakers a championship in 2002, 2003, which would have been their fourth straight because he came into training camp and into that season out of shape. Why? Because he postponed his toe surgery from June to September. Cost the Lakers a championship. They had to fight so hard just to keep their heads above ground during the postseason. During the regular season, they had nothing left in the postseason. Then you couldn't go on a hard home court advantage in any series. Cost them a championship. Phil addresses the defensive comparisons between the two. Both players, Michael and Kobe, made the all-defensive team, first team, 9 times. Jordan was on all-defensive second team once. Kobe was on all-defensive second team 3 times. Now, in my opinion, with the eye test, Michael Jordan was a better defensive player than Kobe Bryant. But, again, Phil basically took shots at Kobe, saying that he didn't understand some of those selections that Kobe Bryant received for all defensive team. Keep this in mind. The same people, maybe not the same exact people, but the same group in terms of that were voting for Kobe Michael Jordan to make all defensive team are the same that were voting for Kobe Bryant to make all defensive team. Those teams, all NBA teams, all defensive teams, are selected by the coaches. So, yes, of course, there were different coaches different coaches when Michael Jordan was playing versus when Kobe Bryant. But the bottom line is they were selected. They were all NBA coaches who watched millions of hours, who watched thousands of countless hours of video, who coached against each other 82 games a year, who's, you know, they see the players. They know the players. So, you know, if you're Phil Jackson, I mean, again, you can't knock the guy defending Kobe Bryant. Well, he made the all-defensive team 13, 12 times. So you're knocking his defense. See, here's where Phil, I think, messed up. Not messed up, but here's where Phil kind of loses you. You don't have to raise Michael. You don't have to knock Kobe Bryant to raise up Michael Jordan. And that's all I think he did with this, and based on these excerpts. He tore down Kobe Bryant while pushing up Michael Jordan. You don't have to do that. And then, to me, this is where when this piece of information comes out, this is where, to me, it all comes clear. During, of course, back in 2003, Kobe Bryant had a situation in Eagle, Colorado, where he was accused of sexual assault on a young lady. Phil Jackson's daughter was sexually assaulted in college, and Phil mentions in the book that he had pent-up aggression, basically, against Kobe Bryant over the course of that 2003-2004 season. That was the season that basically split the Lakers apart. The Lakers lost in Detroit against Detroit in the finals. Shaq was traded. Phil was not. Phil's contract was not renewed, and the Lakers went into another direction. Everybody basically, except Kobe Bryant, everybody basically went their separate ways. So again, even though the fact that Phil came back and they won champion, and before Phil became the coach for a second stint in 2005, 2006, he had to, you know, they had him and Kobe had to pass things up based on a book that Phil had written during the time he was with the Lakers and had been released like right after that 2004-2005 season. That season, of course, that, you know, the Lakers didn't make the playoffs. You had, you know, Reed Tomjanovich, Frank Hamlin as the coach, and that was a disaster. That was the last time the Lakers did not make the playoffs that particular year. So before that season, Phil releases the book. He rips Kobe, says he wanted to trade Kobe the whole nine yards, and then, you know, I heard Phil on radio interviews say that Kobe was, you know, that he wanted to get rid of Kobe Bryant at that particular time. So there's still, you know, and when he says this thing about his daughter, you know, that's your daughter. So I don't care how many championships you won with this guy post that situation, that still has to be inside your heart somewhere. I mean, again, I'm not saying he hasn't forgiven Kobe, but I just can't. I'm not saying that he hasn't, that he doesn't believe that he believes that Kobe actually sexually assaulted that girl. He was cleared of all charges, as we all know. But again, I can't help to think, but that situation did not influence some of the things he said about Kobe Bryant in this book. It just, we're all human beings, especially fathers when it comes to their daughters. So again, Phil Jackson ripping Kobe Bryant, basically, in his book, and obviously I shouldn't say ripping Kobe Bryant, but basically saying that Kobe Bryant doesn't even belong in the same, you know, sentence as Michael Jordan. The book comes out May 21st. Hopefully, I've already put the order in for it. Hopefully, I'll have it before next week's show. If there's anything else that comes out of it that is of interest, we'll talk about it over the course of this show. 347-215-6180 is your call number. This is the Cyril Quinn Review, 47 minutes after the 10 o'clock hour. Again, a busy show. You had the Preakness down in Pimlico, or only 9 horses in this particular race, only 6 starters returning from the Kentucky Derby. Orb is an even money favorite to win the race. The performance in Kentucky Derby at Orb had was one of the most dominant performances I've seen recently in a Triple Crown race. And I'm going to, when he comes on, I'm going to ask Alex Brown, of course, his thoughts on it. But it was a dominant performance. He came basically out of nowhere and lapped the field in the last, you know, basically quarter mile. And it was just, you know, it was breathtaking. It was one of those performances that you just said, as soon as it was over, I said, this is a Triple Crown horse. Not say now, I think that this horse is going to win the Triple Crown. I really do. I think I could be dead wrong. I'm not a horse racing, you know, aficionado, but, you know, when you see, in any sport, when you see dominance and when you see greatness, it stands out. And that race, Orb was dominant. I mean, again, we'll talk to Alex about this, but that last quarter mile was something to see. Of course, Joel Rosario's the jockey. We will see if Orb can break that drought of 34 years. It has been since 35 years, been since 1978 that a horse affirmed has won the Triple Crown. And the horse racing industry, the sport is dying to me for a Triple Crown winner. I mean, a Triple Crown, if you go into Belmont with Orb winning these first two races, there'll be so much juice, just obviously so much juice for that Belmont in New York. And if he is able to win a triple crown, again, that will take the sport to just an absolute whole new level. And I think the sport, I frankly, you know, think the sport, you know, it's been almost a couple of generations since the sport had seen the triple crown. I think the sport needs a triple crown winner, to be honest with you. So we'll talk to Alex Brown about that. NBA playoffs, you'll have Knicks Pacers tonight. Memphis, San Antonio start the Western Conference Finals tomorrow. Miami's going to get a ton of rest, especially if this the Eastern Conference Finals is going to start Monday or Wednesday. Either Monday or Wednesday. Either way, Miami's going to have a long time off. If you're a Miami Heat fan, you have to be somewhat encouraged by Dwayne Wade those last couple minutes of the game in the fourth quarter, though I still have questions about his knee, certainly. Some major questions about his knee and how much he can actually give the Heat moving forward in these playoffs. I don't think they can win a championship without Dwayne Wade being somewhat healthy. Like, he gives you these 10-point games, these 12-point games where he has no impact or very little impact. I don't think they can win a championship like that, to be completely honest with you. Last night, Penguins go up 2-0 on the Ottawa Senators. They did take out the Senators 4-3. Sid the Kid, hat trick for him. When Crosby, Malkin are healthy and playing well, I think Pittsburgh's victory is almost unbeatable, to be honest with you. They've won four straight playoff games ever since they made the switch in the net between the pipes, taking out Marc-Andre Fleury, who, to me, they have to actually move him in the offseason. I just don't think this guy will ever be the same in a Pittsburgh uniform. I don't know what's happened to him, but he clearly just is not the same goalie that we've seen in the past, especially since when they won that Stanley Cup. Thomas Volkoon has come in, done a very good job. Not a great player, but listen, when you have the kind of talent that Pittsburgh has, you don't need great goaltenders. They don't need to have a Dominik Hasek. You know, they don't need to have that type of guy or a Tim Thomas like he was a couple years ago when Boston won the Stanley Cup. They don't need Dominik. I mean, they don't need a dominant goaltender when you have the two best players in the world on your team and a host of young, talented role players. So Pittsburgh's up 2-0 in their series. I think we're headed towards a Pittsburgh, and no disrespect to the Rangers, but I think we're going to head towards a Pittsburgh-Boston Eastern Conference Final and a Kings-Chicago Western Conference Finals. I think right now, Pittsburgh, Chicago, the Kings are the three teams that can win the Stanley, and Boston to a lesser extent that can win the Stanley Cup. I could be dead wrong, but I think those three teams are starting to create separation. Bruce Irvin suspended for the first two games. The Seattle linebacker for testing positive for PEDs. So the first four games. Let me get that right. So that will be a major loss for an excellent Seattle defense. You also have Mike Goodson of the Jets being arrested for gun and drug charges. Titus Young, the situation with him earlier this week and how that ongoing situation keeps coming about, or last week. NFL players are just losing their minds right now. You know, with the most dangerous time, especially in the NFL, because the NFL offseason takes forever. The season ends, for some teams, the season ends in January, okay? So in particular, for those, you know, if you make the playoffs, let's say you get to the playoffs January, early February at the latest. I mean, you have all of February, March, April, May, June, July, August. I mean, again, the NFL offseason is the longest by far in all of sports, and especially in terms of four professional sports, major sports. Even with combines, even with OTAs, these guys have just ample amounts of free time for themselves, and they tend to make choices that just have you shaking your head. And the thing about it is, unlike some of these other sports, whether it be the NBA, whether it be, you know, Major League Baseball, NFL players don't make a ton of money in terms of the everyday player compared to, as in comparison to other sports. Now, good, listen, Drew Brees last year had made $40 million in salary, okay, prior to Aaron Rodgers and Joe Flacco. Drew Brees is the highest paid player in NFL history. Okay, so, but there's Drew Brees. I mean, Drew Brees will go down as all-time great. But the average NFL player is not raking in the kind of money that can afford them to make career-threatening choices when it comes to, you know, getting arrested, at DUIs. You know, they, I mean, these guys can, like, you know, you'll see a lot of times where a player that's not noteworthy gets cut because of what happened. Like Titus Young. Titus Young may never play football again because he's going to end up being in jail. I mean, his life is a wreck right now. And to me, if you're the NFL, the question is, okay, you know, we can build more jails. Come sort of say we can increase, I not build more jails, but we can increase the penalties in terms of the violating the code, conduct code, and suspend more games. But is that really to me, it's not discouraging these guys from doing what they do. To me, how about the NFL puts in some resources to address what's going on in the offseason, programs in place to, you know, to cater to the needs of their players? Because, again, increasing the rule, making the rules tougher, that it worked. For the first year, it worked. Guys got the message, and it worked basically for 1 year. But now it's back to, you know, business as usual with these NFL players. And, you know, Mario Williams could be in some trouble. You also have, and I'm leaving out a player that, right now that can't come to mind. But, again, it's Chad Johnson. To be in some trouble. So clearly, this epidemic of players and getting in trouble in the offseason has returned full throttle. And again, you're Roger Goodell, you're the rest of the NFL, you have to think about what can we do to help support these players. Now, again, the easy solution is for the players to get their act together and make better choices. I mean, that would be obvious. I mean, that's obviously the that would clean everything up. Now, clearly, there are some major issues. I mean, again, it's the NFL. I mean, again, these types of things in baseball, hockey, basketball don't happen nowhere near as much as the NFL. And you're not going to see hockey players get in trouble. Hockey players make no money as a comparison to the other four sports. So they're not hockey players are, you know, they're trying to find investments because Gary Bettman, they make no money. Unless you're a Sidney Crosby or Evan Malkin or, you know, a superstar, Alexander Ovechkin, you're not making any money in terms of a professional athlete, in terms of the other sports, as in comparison to the other sports, not making nothing. So hockey players are not getting in any trouble off the ice. Now, on the ice is another thing, but off the ice, you see very little trouble in terms of hockey players, in terms of the NHL players. But again, the NFL players are all over the place. So, again, something that the NFL needs to look into being proactive instead of reactive. 11 o'clock here on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, 347-215-6180 is your call number. You can follow me on Twitter at William Gerald. You can hit me up. Hit me up on Facebook at facebook.com/SurrealQuinn, or go to my website at SurrealGeraldQuinn.com. I have not seen any of the big movies of yet that have come out. You have three big ones that have came out in terms of Star Trek. Well, Star Trek just came out yesterday. Star Trek, The Great Gatsby, Iron Man 3. I have not heard great things about The Great Gatsby and Iron Man 3. Iron Man 3, I talk to two people that I respect when it comes to movies a lot. I've heard just that Iron Man 3 was just awful, basically. And that you just, you know, don't even waste your money. Wait until Netflix. I mean, that's what I've heard out of Iron Man. So, I'll probably go see Iron Man. I'll definitely see Star Trek. I'm holding out in the Great Gatsby. I'm sorry. I'm a huge Leonardo DiCaprio fan, but I think I've got to hold out on that one. Till Netflix DVD. I'm definitely going to see Fast and Furious. So I'll see the Fast and Furious. I'll see Star Trek, and then you'll have a little gap before Superman comes along and what have you. But I'll definitely see Star Trek, and I'll definitely see Fast and Furious 6. Major League Baseball last night. San Francisco blowing another lead, and their starting pitching getting rocked. They lose Colorado in a key series 10-9. The Giants have, they've won championships with their pitching, with their defense, with their bullpen, and getting clutch hitting, getting a couple of offensive players producing here and there. This year, it's been the complete opposite. They have minutes after the 8 o'clock hour, 12 minutes after the 11 o'clock hour on this 18th of May 2013, as we discuss the world of sports, busy Saturday, busy weekend in the world of sports, this edition of the Cyril Quinn Review, NBA playoffs, a couple series, of course. You have two series still going on in terms of the conference semifinals, or one series still going on in terms of conference semifinals. Knicks, Indiana. George Hill status is still uncertain as far as the concussion goes. Those concussions can be tricky. You know, NFL player gets concussion, if he doesn't pass the test, he normally has to sit out at least a week. That obviously can shift this entire series, because George Hill, frankly, had been the best player in this series, to be honest with you. I mean, there's no two ways about it. I think he had been the most consistent and the best player in this series. He was dominating Raymond Felton prior to the concussion. I thought that George Hill would have played in game five, as close as that game was, that Indiana would have won that game. I mean, the Knicks pulled away late to win by 10, but for the most part, they kept New York within they were within shouting distance of New York even late into the fourth quarter. Just couldn't score, just couldn't generate any offense. Chris Copeland had a big game for the Knicks that gave him a much needed boost in terms of some scoring. But like I say, Indiana's a great home team, but if George Hill doesn't play, there's definitely a possibility that this could get to a seventh game, which would be a shame for Indiana. But to me, Indiana has thoroughly outplayed New York in this series, the two games in Indiana weren't even close. They were more physical than the Knicks. They had, frustrated Carmelo, basically shut down J.R. Smith. The New York role players have struggled. Yeah, I thought Indiana was playing a great series, minus the game two, was playing a great series. And this, again, injuries can, injury has been, this postseason has been like a war of attrition with guys getting hurt or coming into the postseason hurt left and right. And this would be, a devastating injury for the Indiana Pacers if George Hill is not able to continue. Memphis, San Antonio should be a very interesting series in terms of contrast of styles. San Antonio, I thought, made an adjustment in terms of Golden State of slowing the game down in the last couple games and making it a half-court execution-type game. The beginning of the series, they tried to run with him. That did not work out. They are going to want to speed up the pace against Memphis. They don't want any part of a half-court physical game against the Memphis Grizzlies. The Memphis Grizzlies right now, and again, are playing as well as any team in the playoffs, considering the competition. Miami has not played anyone in the playoffs this year. I mean, see, the Chicago series, they play a half a team, and they play a team that was, frankly, not a playoff team in Milwaukee. So it's almost hard to even gauge Miami based on the two opponents that they faced. Memphis, to me, is playing better. Is playing the best basketball of anybody in the playoffs up to this point. They dominated the Clippers after those first two games. They've won 8 out of their last 9 playoff games. Even their game one, even their loss against Oklahoma City was a close loss in game one. They went 4 straight. Now, okay, Westbrook or no Westbrook, it's hard. It is difficult and impressive to close a team on the road. And to me, far too much is being made of no Russell Westbrook, too much on Kevin Durant. The Memphis team is a very good team. I mean, they had the best front court forward center tandem in the league right now, by far, in Randolph and Gasol. You have an elite top defensive player in Tony Allen. You have an underrated point guard who's playing great right now in Mike Conley Jr. They have underrated depth with Bayless, Poindexter, guys of that nature. even Tayshaun Prince, in terms of their role players, have played well. This is a very good basketball team, and a team I feel like that is capable of winning a championship. You know, I like them. I like them in the San Antonio series. I don't think physically San Antonio can handle them down low. I think they will physically pound San Antonio. I question where San Antonio is going to get scoring outside of Parker and Duncan. Ginobili's been up and down, shaky. Kawhi Leonard has been up and down. Danny Green, those has been up and down. They have had, San Antonio has not had a consistent third scorer over the course of this, especially the course of this Golden State series. So, I like Golden State. I like Memphis in this series. I understand San Antonio, it's the eighth time in the last 16 years they've been in the conference finals. We know how experienced they are. But I get the sense that the Spurs are kind of running on their last legs right now. I think they used energy and guile to get past the Golden State. And plus, let's be honest, Golden State was physically breaking down the last part of that series. I mean, you had Curry basically was at 70% with the ankle. You had, I don't know what happened to Klay Thompson. I think it's more of a lack of experience from him. You had Harrison Barnes, who emerged to me as a guy who has a chance to be an all-star in a couple of years. You had him getting hurt in the last game. So there was a lot of things that went against Golden State in those last couple of games. And plus, listen, we talked about it last week in the opening. You know, they were just inexperienced. You know, they got to go through those. They had to go through the growing pains. They had to go through the battles. That team, though, to me, is built to win a championship in the future. They do not need a lot of pieces. You know, you re-sign Jared Jack. You have Curry and Thompson. Harrison Barnes, to me, emerged in this postseason as a guy who can be a legit number three option. They have depth. They have depth coming off their bench, quality depth. You know, you keep Andrew Bogut healthy. So they have a lot. They have a lot going for them in the future. Their roster right now. Again, of course, you have to keep Curry healthy with his ankle, but there is not a better roster, top to bottom, in the Western Conference. They have one of the best rosters in the NBA, to be honest with you, from top to bottom. And that team, that team is built for the future. So it should be a very, very good series with Memphis and San Antonio. This could be it for San Antonio. This could be it for San Antonio without question, as they, try to get Tim Duncan that elusive fifth championship. We are now joined by Alex Brown of The Rail, New York Times, who always has joined us to preview these Triple Crown races. Alex, good morning. How are you doing today?
Phil, sorry for being a little bit late. Just been walking around the States Barn here at Pimlico and trying to see what's going on with these horses, getting ready for the big race later on today.
No question, Alex. This race has a lot of juice to it, considering what transpired at the Kentucky Derby. And before we get into this particular race, let's talk about that Kentucky Derby. Alex, for my money, that performance by Orv was, to me, the best performance I've seen by a horse since Big Brown in 2008. What were your thoughts on that performance?
You could possibly be right. I mean, I think a lot of people are very high on Orv after that Kentucky Derby win. I'm one of them. I like the horse going into the race. He was training great going into the Derby. And as ridiculously fast a pace as the race was run in the terrible conditions, Orv just waited at the back and then at the half-mile pole, made a move. And at that half-mile pole, even though he only had two horses behind him, I was like, wow, this horse is going to win it from here. I mean, he just looked phenomenally the best at that point. And I honestly, he only won by 2.5 lengths, so I think he could have won further if he was challenged. He was just the superior horse on the day.
No question about Alex that he was the best that you looked at that horse and you said, and I said to myself at when it was happening, you know, that last quarter mile, that this is a Triple Crown horse. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that thought jumped out in my mind. Was that by, you know, first of all, were you surprised? Because I remember when I had you on the show that day, you didn't like Orb at all in terms of if the track, if the conditions were bad and the track was wet. Like, I had you picked your horses and Orb was not in that top three if the horse is wet. How much did it shock you that he could give that kind of performance on a wet track?
Well, let me qualify my picks for the Derby. My thought process, even if it came off a little bit wrong, was Orb was the best horse going into the race. My only concern is if the track comes up bad, that can just change anything. I wasn't particularly concerned Orb versus other horses handling a bad track. I just think whenever the track's bad, you can never really handicap to the extent that you can when you've got a true run fast race track. I thought he was the best horse going into the Derby, and what he proved to me in the Derby was, regardless of the racetrack, he can handle it, and he was by far the best horse that day. So he proved that point. Yeah.
No question. And that's the thing that jumped out to me, Alex, that, you know, we both thought that he was the best horse going in. But when I saw the wet track, I thought that, you know, all bets are off, basically. We could see a number of horses possibly win that race.
Yeah.
That performance on the wet track, to me, said, you know, that spoke volumes about just how much better this horse is than everybody else.
And also, honestly, the race would run in a ridiculous fashion. So you can shoot all the jockeys that were on the front end of that pace, because those professional jockeys should know they were going way too quick. And if you look at Orb One, he came from third from last. The horses also came from the back. So the race kind of set up for him in the end with the ridiculous pace that Mike Smith and Velasquez and those guys. But nevertheless, in my book, Orb was the best horse going into the Derby, and he proved to be the best horse in the race, and he's been training terrific in the 2 weeks leading up to the Preakness.
Now we enter the Preakness, Alex. Only 9 horses in this race.
You have
no Normandy Invasion. How do you look at this field versus, say, the Kentucky Derby field? How does this field, like, compare to, you know, I'm not going to compare to the Kentucky Derby field because it's not fair, because there's only six out of 19 starters that are going to be racing in this particular race. How do you compare this field to past Preakness fields as far as the strength of the field and what have you?
I think, quite frankly, Orb scared at some serious contenders away. The second, third, and fourth horses are not coming back in the Preakness, and they're not coming back for a very good reason. They're decent horses, and they don't want to get beat by Orb again. So the only, you know, you're getting the fifth-place finisher, the sixth-place finisher, the eighth-place finisher, and then two that were completely trounced in the Derby coming back to face Orb again. So obviously on Derby form and on any form that you can conceive, Orb is the better horse of those six by far. And you're getting 3 new shooters. Some are rooting for departing because they think, you know, he's only had 1 loss and ran pretty well in the Illinois Derby. But my question with departing is, who has he beaten thus far? He's really not faced this kind of horse. So, you know, the only case that you can make for horses to compete against Orb is if you can say, well, they didn't get to run their race in the Derby. You can say Golden Sense and It's My Lucky Day ran so poorly in the Derby that it wasn't their true form. And that's what their trainers will tell you at this point. Until they run in the Preakness, that's what they'll tell you. And then if they repeat their performance in the Derby and the Preakness, then obviously we know that they're just not good enough. But some would say, well, Golden Sense, and It's My Lucky Day, they could turn it around a little bit today.
Who to you is the biggest threat to take out Orb today?
Orb himself. If Orb doesn't fire his best shot, that's the biggest threat. I think if Orb fires his best shot, nobody's going to compete with him today.
Wow. That's
I mean, that's the prevailing wisdom here. I mean, like I say, the horse is training good. He put in a real nice work on Monday, much like he did ahead of the Derby. So he doesn't seem to be suffering any ill effects from his Derby performance. If Orb shows up and runs his race, he will be extremely difficult for these kind of horses to beat. People will be like, well, he's in the one hole, is that a problem? I don't care if he starts from the grandstand. I think he's just a better horse than these guys.
So you don't put any stock. You don't put any stock into it. It's not. And I read that considering how small the field is, that starting off on the rail is not that big a deal. You agree with that as well?
Yeah. No big deal at all. I mean, he's got speed right on the outside of him, Golden Sense. So probably if things play out the way they probably should, Golden Sense. And the horse just outside of him, Title Town, whatever his name is, who shouldn't be in the race at all. They'll clear Orb pretty quickly, giving Orb plenty of room on the rail without a horse immediately on his outside. So I just don't see how this race doesn't set up nicely for Orb.
Talk about what are your thoughts on Governor Charlie.
He won the Sunderland Park Derby, trained by Bob Baffert, so... You know, he'll get some play. I guess he had a bit of a foot problem, which took him out of consideration for the Derby. So he's feeling fresh. He put in a strong work, I guess, sometime last weekend, 10 and change, three quarters in down at Churchill, I think. People are betting because it's Bob Baffert.
Right. He's won
these kind of horses. Sorry? Yes. I mean, he knows how to win a Triple Crown race, so he'll get plenty of action. He'll be third or fourth choice. But I just don't think he's the same kind of horse that Orb is at this point of their careers anyway.
So
I was talking to Shug McGay earlier, Orb's trainer. I mean, I did that out asking, what do you think your chances are? I mean, he just seems very quietly confident in his horse. In his situation anyway. The team looks pretty casual and focused, so you're getting a real good vibe out of that camp, I think.
Another thing Orb has going for him, as if it needs any more, positives and going towards that direction, is only, and I saw this stat as this was blown away, only three horses in the last 29 years have won the Preakness after not running in the Kentucky Derby. What do you attribute that to?
Well, I mean, the reality is the best horses typically run in the Kentucky Derby, right? So if you have a top three-year-old, the way our industry is set up right now, you want to compete in the Derby. So typically the horses coming fresh into the Preakness are just not quite as good a caliber of horses, the horses that ran in the Derby. So that's the key reason. There's always going to be the odd exception to that, and hence why you do end up getting two or three winners that are coming in fresh. So the horses that didn't run in the Derby do have the advantage that they can focus for this race, having to focus on preparing for the Derby and then trying to recover and come back for this race. That being said, the advantage that Derby horses have is typically they're just a better horse. So you've got the better horse versus the fresher horse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yes, that you, if you're making that choice between the fresher versus the better horse, that you're going to take the talent without question.
Right.
So, Alex, again, it sounds like it sounds like it's just, it's Orb and everybody else in this particular race. Out of all the, and we know how hard it is to win a Triple Crown based on the fact that it hasn't happened since 1978, out of all the three races, is this the easiest race to win if you want to win a Triple Crown in terms of the Preakness in your mind?
No, I'd say this is the hardest. If Orb wins today, then there'll be a huge momentum toward the Triple Crown.
Why do you think this is an artist?
And I'll have another situation. This is not a Smarty Jones situation. This is not a real quiet. This, Bob and the team surrounding him, if they win the Preakness, you can go to the bar and party your ass off. This horse will be a very, very strong favorite to take the Triple Crown.
Okay.
This is the hardest of the two remaining legs. Simply because coming back in 2 weeks, you just don't really know how a horse has recovered from the Derby until they run in this race. Like, he's training good, he's breathing good, but until they really push the button today, you don't know what the Derby's taken out of them.
Right.
And
right.
The fact that the Belmont's 3 weeks removed from the Preakness, that's more of an ideal period to prepare a horse for a race. Typically, as horsemen, we like to space our races out 3 weeks to 4 weeks at a time.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. Quick turnaround, quick turnaround from Preakness to not Preakness, but from Derby to Preakness. But I would think, Alex, that if you win the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, you go into Belmont. Mm. I would think that that the Belmont will feature all the best horses as well, and some of those horses that didn't run the Preakness will be running in the Belmont.
Yeah.
The track being longer, but I know that this horse is built for endurance. So I don't think the fact that the Belmont is a longer track will affect.
On pedigree, on paper, I think this horse will be fine for the Belmont. I mean, you're right in the sense there'll be a couple of horses that ran in the Derby that'll dock the Preakness and back into the Belmont. Probably the horse that finished second in the Derby will do that. He was an outsider. And there'll be a few more. So they have the advantage. Again, they're fresher coming into the Belmont. But, I think Orby's just better than any of those horses. And he'll have the 3 weeks to prepare. Shug McGee, top-class horseman, top-class team. They're based at Belmont. I mean, the race, the Belmont sets up so well for this horse. If he comes out of the Preakness physically in good shape and he wins the Preakness, obviously, then this will be the best shot we've had at a Triple Crown for many, many years.
Do you think if he does, it will be even a better shot than Big Brown in 2008?
I'd say it would be on with that. If you remember Big Brown going into the Belmont, I mean, I can't remember what betting odds he was, but he was ridiculously short priced. He dominated the Derby Preakness. I mean, who knew that horse would get beaten in the Belmont, right?
Nobody. It was just an
odd set of circumstances that got it done. He wasn't going to get beat if he ran his race. And that's the same with Orb. If Orb gets to run his race in the Preakness and if he gets to run his race in the Belmont, I cannot fathom a horse beating him.
You mentioned this earlier about the ridiculous pace that these horses start out with in that Kentucky Derby. And I was blown away by it, too. I was like, man, this is like, this pace is fast. Why do you think those and only one, and the funny thing about it is, out of those first five or six horses that started out with the quick start, only one of them finished like in the top six or seven.
Why did
those jockeys make that mistake? I mean, you figure that they, you know, that you have a strategy going into it. You discuss it with your trainers, kind of like a coach with his players. You know, we're going to do this. This is how we're going to play it. Why did that occur?
I mean, honestly, I don't know what Mike Smith was thinking. I mean, he was on Palace Malice. He basically set the ridiculously fast pace. I mean, his excuse was he got run off with and he couldn't rate the horse. I've watched the race a bunch of times. I didn't see where he tried to rate the horse. So I was kind of just disgusted with those tactics. John Velasquez, Hall of Fame jockey, considered the best in North America. He was way too close to that pace on Barrazzano, didn't give him a shot. And two or three others, the Golden Sense, I mean, he was way too close to that pace. I presume it's My Lucky Day was too. And those two are coming back in this. And that's whether they're so close to that fast early and they can actually run a better race if they're out of fitness.
So, So it should be an interesting race this week with the Preakness, certainly. Alex, as always, thanks for joining us, and I have a pretty good feeling that come 3 weeks from now, 3 weeks from this Saturday, that we could be on the brink of possibly some history again as far as Orb going for the Triple Crown. Certainly, definitely be rooting for Orb, keeping my fingers crossed for that. Definitely would be
Everybody's rooting for him.
As I mentioned earlier, Alex, it would take the sport to a whole other level if this sports were to able to win the Triple Crown.
And also, there are some people you just really root for in our sport, and certainly this group of people, Shug McGay, his group, these are old school people. They do things a traditional way. If they can win the Triple Crown for the sport, it will say a lot about true horsemanship and just really the way things should get done.
No question about it. Alex, as always, thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Brilliant. Thanks a lot, mate. Take care.
Right, take it easy. Of course, Alex Brown, and like many people, everybody likes Orb. I mean, I haven't seen anybody not pick Orb to win this race, period. That performance he had in the Kentucky Derby was flat out just dominant. It was a dominant performance. I think, I agree with Alex. I mean, I think it's his race to lose when you look at these other contenders as a comparison to him. It's his race to lose. This looks to me to be a dominant horse without question. And it'll be a very, very interesting race to watch over the course of today. Again, posting time will be at 6:20. Of course, they'll have coverage starting basically all day. But this should be a certainly exciting race. Listen, you want Orb to win. That's all you're hoping for. You want Orb to win. You just want to see how he looks if he wins. In terms of just how much he laps the field, and I mean, you just want to see, you want to see what he looks like coming off that dominant performance, in the Kentucky Derby, the last quarter mile. And Alex mentioned it. I don't understand why why that ridiculous pace was set by those five or six horses. At the Kentucky Derby, I mean, they had nothing, and I mean, they had nothing left. They had nothing left down the stretch, and Orb just blew right past them. I mean, he was at his best when they were at their worst. And again, I don't understand that. I don't understand that, horse racing, I mean, it's, in all sports, there's strategy and coaching, and horse racing is no different. So I'm sure the trainers of these horses were like, hey, don't get off to a fast start, gauge the field where you're at. I'm sure all those conversations took place prior to the race, but apparently they were not followed by those horses, by those particular jockeys. 347-215-6180 is the call number. So the Sacramento Kings are going to be the Sacramento Kings next year. The Maloofs have sold it to a group, Ramadiv, for $535 million, 65% of the team. So he's going to have majority ownership, and it's fine. Listen, Sacramento fans are great fans. They support that team, even when that team stunk in the Mitch Richmond years, and even when that team has stunk post Chris Webber, Vlade Divac years. Here's the thing about this whole deal that I don't understand. The NBA earlier in the week turned out, you know, the NBA earlier in the week owners voted 22-8 to keep the team in Sacramento and not have the team move to Seattle. The Seattle offer, okay, that was made by a guy by the name of Chris Hansen, was for $625 million total, including a $490 million arena deal. Never in the history of the NBA has a team, has an offer been better to a team, to a prospective team that was selling, to a prospective seller of a team, ever. I mean, like, no offer has, that's the best offer that's ever been made in NBA history. You have Kevin Johnson, okay, the mayor of Sacramento, and other investors and guys and other people just scrambling for money, okay? Scraping and clawing for money to try to keep the team in Sacramento, okay? Sacramento, since 2002, has gone through about six different deals and where they were trying to get a arena built downtown that had fallen through. All right. They've been working on an arena deal since November 2002 to get an arena built. You have a guy who basically said, listen, we have the money. We have it. Not only has the best offer, you have a basketball-rich city in Seattle. See, when the Supersonics were in Seattle, those were some of the best fans in the NBA. Those teams were constantly title-contending teams. They won a championship in 79. And again, in 79, it's 1979, but still. But perennially, Seattle City Supersonics were, especially in the 90s, were contenders. So I don't understand how you can compare Seattle to Sacramento. I don't get it. Where is the history with the Sacramento Kings? Where is it? They went to a Game 7 against the Lakers in 2002 and haven't been heard from since. And again, when it comes, you know, when you look behind the scenes of these deals with, you know, teams trying to move here, all, you know, prospective investors trying to buy this team, trying to buy that team, normally the bottom line is the money. I mean, this is the first time I've ever seen the money not be the difference in terms of who was able to buy the team versus who was not approved to buy the team. I've never seen this in my life, where money was not the ultimate determinant, was not the ultimate factor in terms of where this team was sold or who bought this team. So I just don't get, you know, this love affair with Sacramento by David Stern. You're telling me the franchise is better off in Sacramento than it is in Seattle? I don't buy that. I've seen what Seattle has done over the course of their history. I've seen what Sacramento has done over the course of its history. It pretty much is not a comparison. And this guy, Chris Hansen, who put in the Seattle bid in terms of the offer, raised his price twice during this whole ordeal. And again, by my math, $625 million is more than $535 million. You mean to tell me that NBA is going to leave $90 million on the table? The Maloofs wanted no part of selling. The Maloofs basically were almost forced to sell to this Ramanov guy. They wanted the Seattle bid. They wanted the Seattle offer, and like, there are 90 million reasons why they wanted the Seattle offer. The Maloofs didn't want any part of the Ramanov offer versus the Hansen offer. Why? Because one guy offered them $90 million. I mean, come on. Again, there was no legit reason that David Stern gave to keep the team in Sacramento they were the incumbents. I mean, that's not a reason. I'm sorry. That's not like, come on. Are the people in Sacramento better than the people in Seattle? I mean, come on. How do we gauge that? Now, Seattle is going to get a franchise. Probably they're probably going to go the expansion route. But this was absolutely ridiculous how Sacramento still has this team. I mean, think about it. Somebody comes up to you and they say, "Man, I want this coat that you have on." Two people come to you and say, "I want your coat." One person says, "You know what, I'll give you $1,000 for that coat." The other person, says, "Okay, I'll give you $400, but hold on. Let me see if I can borrow some more money." So they borrow more money, and then their offer comes out, "Oh, okay, I'll give you $700. You're still taking the $1,000. I mean, come on. I mean, you appreciate the effort that goes into that went into trying to raise more money, but you're still, at the end of the day, I would think that you're still taking $1,000 over the $700. That's how I felt. That's what it felt like with this. Like, one guy made an offer that was, hey, $625 million versus another group, $535 million. And, to me, it was cut and dry. Yeah, like, what else is there to discuss? Okay, one guy, one group had more money to spend than the other group. Is your call number on this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. We began the program talking about Phil Jackson, Michael Jordan, and Kobe Bryant. Phil Jackson's book coming out, 11 Rings, Soul of Success, coming out this Tuesday. There were a couple of excerpts that had been leaked to the media that have come out of the book. I should say leaked because, every Los Angeles Times had it in regards to the Kobe Bryant, Michael Jordan comparison. Phil Jackson leaving no doubt in his mind who the better player is. And, like I say, it was more like a first round knockout than this back and forth. Michael Jordan's better leader. Michael Jordan's physically stronger. Michael Jordan's a better defender. Michael Jordan's a more efficient scorer. The whole nine yards. I think Michael Jordan was the better player. But if you listen to Phil, Kobe Bryant doesn't even belong in any conversation with Michael Jordan, which to me is just ridiculous. It's asinine. I mean, the guy's going to retire with who knows how many points, 35,000 points, 40,000 points, who knows, 5 championships, 6. I mean, who knows how many. I mean, he still has the opportunity to win another championship, depending on how long he's played. And, again, this is the one thing that people have made a mistake of in terms of gauging Michael Jordan, this idea that Michael Jordan, that there's Michael Jordan and everybody else, that nobody, no other players that have ever played as on his level. It's not the case. There are at least 3 or 4 of them that I can name, and Kobe Bryant is in that group. It's one thing to raise up Michael Jordan, but another thing to tear down Kobe Bryant. And I felt like Phil Jackson subtly tore down Kobe Bryant because he talks about Kobe Bryant's defense and basically said that Kobe Bryant should not have been on all defense, those number of times. That's one thing. Listen, Michael Jordan was a better defensive player than Kobe Bryant. Yes, he was. Michael Jordan won defensive player of the year. Won defensive player of the year in 1988. Kobe Bryant has never been close to being defensive player of the year. So, I will never disagree with that standpoint. But the bottom line is Kobe Bryant was on the all league defense first team 9 times and was second team 3 times. Okay. And again, the same people that voted Kobe Bryant all-league defense were the same people that were voting Michael Jordan all-league defense. It was voted on by the coaches. That's why you see the discrepancy in terms of a Marc Gasol winning defensive player of the year but making second team all-league defense. The coaches vote on the team, the all-league team awards. The media votes on the individual awards, defensive player of the year, most improved, MVP, rookie of the year, and so on. But again, you had coaches voting for Michael Jordan. You had coaches voting for Kobe Bryant. So I don't see, I don't see how you can't say that Kobe Bryant. I don't see how you can't say that Kobe Bryant was not a great defensive player if he made all league defense 12 times. That just does not make sense. It doesn't. So, I think Phil, I'm not going to say out of line because you value his opinion more than anyone when it comes to comparing those two players. Without question, he coached them in all 11 championships, he coached both Bryant and Jordan in their championship, in all their championship years. He's seen them, coached them, and when they were at their absolute best, their prime of their career. So, he has a better gauge than anybody walking the face of this earth on, Kobe Bryant and Michael Jordan. But I think that, I think that he did not give Kobe Bryant enough credit. I mean, I think Kobe Bryant has a better mid-range game, had a better mid-range game than Michael Jordan, to be honest with you. I think that you can argue that Kobe Bryant has a better post game than Michael Jordan. That's certainly debatable. I think, and as far as the leadership goes, again, I don't think it's fair to compare them as leaders, considering the different circumstances that they played, with in terms of different teams that they played on. Michael Jordan came to the league as a grown man, 21 years old, 3 years of college, played. Played in the 84 Olympics, okay, under Bobby Knight. So he came in as a grown man, okay. So he understood more about life in general, had more life skills, had more, and Phil talks about this too, had more just social skills than Kobe Bryant per se. Kobe Bryant comes into the league as a teenager. He's 17 years old, all right? 17 years old. He wasn't partying. He wasn't clubbing with the other guys on the team. He comes on a team that has Shaquille O'Neal, Robert Horry, Rick Fox, guys like that. All right. So he comes on a team with guys who are established, Eddie Jones, Nick Van Exel, Eldon Campbell, established veterans. All right. Okay. And, guys like Robert Horry had championships. So, of course, he's not going to lead them. I don't care how talented he is. I'm sure they knew, those guys knew how talented Kobe Bryant was and that this guy could be scary in the future. I'm sure they knew that by practicing against him and with him during, of course, those early years. But it was clear cut that Shaquille O'Neal was the guy and the man on that team. Michael Jordan, the team was built around him. He was the biggest star. He was was going to set the league on fire, which he did. So there was no question of who you were going to follow. And again, it's hard to not Kobe Bryant as a leader when you have guys like a Trevor Ariza, Lamar Odom, a Paul Gasol, a Andrew Bynum, who had the best years of their careers. And in some cases, haven't been the same since they left the Lakers, playing with Kobe Bryant. So to me, if a player gets better playing with you, I don't see how that's not leadership or high-level leadership. And I don't see how, a player gets better playing with you. To me, that's saying that what you're doing is rubbing off on him. Paul Gasol made the All-NBA team twice, playing with Kobe Bryant. And he was the man in Memphis. He was the franchise player in Memphis. Didn't make the All-NBA team once. Lamar Odom was sixth man of the year with Kobe Bryant. Had the best years of his career with the Lakers playing with Kobe Bryant. Before that, he was considered erratic and inconsistent. After that, he has not been a factor in the NBA. Now, Andrew Bynum was injured this year, but even, you know, playing with Kobe Bryant, he had the last year, he had the best year of his career. He was second team All-NBA. And, you know, people say, Kobe, you know, Jordan made, Pippen, he made, and Pippen doesn't get enough credit. He made Horace Grant, he made all these other role players. Fine, you want to give them credit for raising their levels of their games? No problem with that. But you can't sit up here and say that Kobe Bryant did not do the same thing for the players, the names of the players that I just gave you. Again, I think there's an anti to me, and not just Phil Jackson, but just think there's an anti somewhat Kobe sentiment. I just don't think Kobe Bryant was liked. Conversations about him versus all-time greats would be a little bit different, including Chip. Including Michael Jordan would be a little bit different. I mean, just a tad different. I think there's a sense of popularity contest. There's no question about it. But again, this idea that Kobe Bryant is not on the level of Michael Jordan is insane. Insane. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. I'd like to thank Alex Brown for coming on the program, giving us a Preakness preview. He likes Orb, so do I. Hopefully, a couple 3 weeks, we will have a Triple Crown preview in terms of the Belmont and have a horse make history. Enjoy the playoffs. Knicks, Pacers tonight. George Hill status unknown. Memphis afternoon, kicking off the Western Conference Finals. That's going to wrap it up for this latest edition of the Cyril Quinn Review. I will see you next week.